Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest today, Corey Robin, professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of a new collection of essays on the right called The Reactionary Mind, just out from Oxford University Press. Before that, just a quick comment on the Occupy Wall Street protest in New York. I admire what the participants are doing. I think it has the potential to spread and grow. But I wish they'd be less shy about articulating an agenda. Most of the talk is about process. Why? I think it's a living instance of something that the political scientist Jody Dean identified in a blog post last November. As she says, after the new left delegitimized the old one, it made political will into an offense. Among the crimes, in her words, taking the place of or speaking for another, the crime of representation, obscuring other crimes and harms, the crime of exclusion, judging, condemning, failing to acknowledge the large terrain of complicating factors, the crime of dogmatism, and employing dangerous, totalizing fantasies that lead to genocidal adventurism, the crime of utopianism. An agenda and an organization, some kind of leadership that could speak and be spoken to, would violate these rules. But without those things, as Jody says, there can be no politics. Occupiers, I love you. I'm glad you're there. The people I talk to are inspiring. But you really have to move beyond this. We need to think about new modes of organization because all this spontaneous, leaderless stuff can't last. More on this on my blog, lbo-news.com. Back after a musical break.
A self-ordained professor's tongue, too serious to fool, spouted out that liberty is just equality in school. Equality, I spoke the word as if a wedding vow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
That was Bob Dylan's My Back Pages. I know I'm betraying my generation by saying this, but I don't much like Bob Dylan. I think his lyrics often make no sense. But this song strikes me as a right-wing anthem. Listen to the way he spits out the word equality and uses the word liberty. Liberty is often a right-wing word. My guest today is Corey Robin, professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of a new collection of essays called The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. For the last 10 years or so, Corey's been writing from the left on the right, and this book collects those essays together into a very readable and enlightening volume. I recommend it enthusiastically. Before hitting the play button, a bit of personal background. Long ago, in the early 70s, when I was a freshman at Yale, I was a member of a strange thing called the Party of the Right. In the 8th grade, I had a history teacher who gave a very sympathetic lecture on Marx. I came home and announced to my parents that I'd become a Marxist. I remained something of one until my senior year in high school, when for some reason, probably something having to do with adolescent rebellion, I became a conservative. When I got to college, about the first thing I did was to join the Party of the Right. I didn't last in it. By the middle of my sophomore year, I'd given up the conservatism and moved back to the left, where I've been ever since. For anyone who's interested, I've written a couple of pieces, one for The Nation and one for a webzine called Bad Subjects, on the experience. Just Google my name, Doug Henwood, and Party of the Right, and you can find them. It was a weird detour, but I'm grateful for it. It helped me understand how the right thinks and feels, which is something that few on the left understand. Corey is an exception, though he never had an off-road experience like mine. Corey Robin.
Welcome, Corey. So, unlike me, you have no history in the right. So how'd you develop this strange interest in the right coming from the left?
Well, I'd say it was two things. One, in graduate school, I read a couple of books that, for me, were really transformative books. One was Arno Mayer's The Persistence of the Old Regime. I had taken his course as an undergraduate, but if you don't know Arno, he's a Marxist historian, but of a very peculiar sort, who argued that, against a lot of progressive and conservative historiography, that the old regime, the literal old regime of Europe, actually persists And his argument, really up until 1945, that 1945 is really the final destruction. And I was very sort of taken with his argument and started beginning to think about to what extent it applies in the United States. And then another is a book by Karen Oren, who's a political scientist at UCLA, who makes an argument about the persistence of feudal forms in the United States in forms of the labor law and employment law in the workplace. So those were some intellectual touchstones for me that I had just been mulling over. And then in 2000, it was really almost by accident, Alex Starr at Lingua Franca had asked me to do a piece on John Gray, who was a political scientist, political theorist, who had been an arch Thatcherite and was kind of moving to the left of some sort in the 90s, and also Edward Luttwak, who had been a big Reaganite, who was also moving to the left. And I think we spoke about that piece at the
time. Yeah, I had during the radio after that. We had Luttwak on.
That's right.
We actually had to suppress the studio sound at one point because he was provoking laughter.
Yeah, I forgot about he was on that. But anyway, and that was just, I kind of stumbled onto it. And the thing that I was really taken by, and you might remember this, was the romanticism of both these guys when they had been conservatives. For Luttwak, it was the romance of war. And for Gray, it was the romance of the market. I'd known that there was a romantic streak in conservatism. That wasn't new to me. But what was new to me, or at least what I hadn't quite reckoned with, was A, that streak had really persisted into the modern era. I mean, I really thought of it as a kind of 19th century, you know, kind of a literary gothic romanticism on the right that you see in people like Disraeli or Coleridge. But here it is, you know, appearing in the 1990s, number one. And number two, particularly in Gray's case, that it could have been hijacked on behalf of something that, to my mind, was so anti-romantic, the market. And how that came together was just sort of fascinating to me. And I wrote that piece thinking that these guys are kind of outliers. They represent a stream within conservatism, but, you know, it's just that. And I think with time, I've come to see that, in fact, they're not outliers. They actually represent something much more fundamental about the whole conservative project. And that's how I got into it.
You got a couple of great quotes of that piece, which is in this book. One, I recall something about Irving Kristol saying something like, making money, business is really dull. If you want a real political philosopher, read Marx. And you got William Buckley to say that if he were young today, he'd be some kind of Marxist or new leftist. Now, are they outliers in that sense, too? I mean, you don't hear that coming from the right very often. What does moment of candor reveal to you?
I think what it does reveal, and what's something that is, I think, very common, is this Jacobin agonistic tendency on the right, which I think starts with Burke. And then that's part of the argument of the book. It's the idea of using political instruments for a grand project. Now, the grand project happens to be counter-revolutionary, and people think, well, if it's counter-revolutionary, then how can it be revolutionary? And they get all caught up in the sort of the nomenclature. But what I came to realize is that the right actually learns from the left. This is a really, really critical phenomenon that I've seen time and time and again. They come up against a revolutionary movement, the French Revolution. However, and I take a very broad church view of what is a revolution. But they come up against a kind of an emancipatory movement and are repelled by it for many reasons. But they come to appreciate the kind of the political potency of that mass mobilization. And they come to appreciate the capacity of political actors to really order political time. The Jacobins want it's the great leap forward. We declare the year one. The counter-revolutionary says, well, if they can declare the year one, why can't we declare the year not one? And that is very, very different from your kind of traditional old regime, which is kind of just bumbling along, taking care of things. And that's a lesson, I think, that they get from the revolution. And you see it time and again. And, you know, for instance, the neocons, everybody always has said, oh, they're Trotskyists of the right, they're Jacobins of the right, da, da, da. And that was there's some truth to that, but there's nothing new about that. Burke was a Jacobin of the right. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people haven't really wrestled with.
Yeah, the left today, though, really is lacking in energy. It doesn't have a revolutionary project. It's very weak and self-questioning and tentative.
before we started recording, we were talking about the Occupy Wall Street protests, which are don't have an agenda at all, really, and their agenda seems to be process and consensus, but it's kind of empty of content. And even there's a certain temperamental conservatism on the left these days, like the old, they're kind of defending the old ways, the local and the small, which used to be thought of as projects of the right, but in fact the left is not doing that. Yet, the right then, I mean, you go back to Reagan, I happened to be listening to his first inaugural address some months ago, and was impressed by, we must not go back to the old ways. We would maybe have some sacrifices to make in the short term, but there'd be a long-term payoff. It was a real revolutionary message and a sense of making history anew, something our current president never, ever did, even though he's, you know, always liked to talk about change, but he's not really done that. So how do you explain this contrast? It seems like the right has appropriated, as you say, has been doing this for a long time, a lot of the language of the left about revolution. If the left has gotten sort of tired and conservative, it seems, at least temperamentally.
Yeah. I would say defensive. I wouldn't say conservative because not to be too pedantic about it, but I do think the whole question of past and future and you know, are we traditional or are we forward-looking is almost a very confusing set of axes on which to look at the left and the right. What I want to argue is that what distinguishes the left and the right is your fundamental question about privilege and hierarchy, basically, what your attitude is about that. So all the rest in some ways is commentary. So you get some conservatives who are, you know, what you were talking about, very traditional, very local and all the rest of it. Burke does that all the time. And then in the same next sentence, he's very avant-garde and internationalist. And so that is a kind of repertoire that I think both left and right shift back and forth on. I mean, E.P. Thompson created a whole, and Raymond Williams created a whole vision of the left that was about customs and traditions and all the rest of it. And that can change. I do think there's no question that the left, I wouldn't even say it's defensive because it's not even clear what it's defending anymore. But what's interesting to me is exactly what you're just saying, which is how the right, really beginning in the 1960s, you know, managed to hijack that. And what I would say, one of the problems with the left is I think they never understood that about the right, until in some ways it was too late. So you see a lot of very defensive responses to the right beginning in the 70s, beginning in the 70s, 80s, and
90s. Patronizing and mocking very often.
On the one hand, there's that. But on the other hand, there's, and I'm thinking particularly of kind of more communitarian-ish oriented, more religious lefty types who think that the reason why the right was so successful was that because they were, you know, appealing to kind of traditional values and local values. And so therefore the left had to kind of mimic them. And if you read Reagan, and I always tell people, go back to Reagan, go back to Goldwater, that's just not the man. It's exactly what you're saying. It's all about this kind of Jacobin great leap forward into the future, into the unknown, and praising it precisely because it's so completely unfamiliar. That's the great American experiment. That's the exciting American drama. And that's why people voted for him.
Oh, I remember watching Reagan's speeches sometimes thinking, they're very seductive. I said, yeah, that's what it is. Like, and it stopped. But what am I saying?
Right.
But he was very good at that.
He was.
You know, I think people underestimated him to the planet's peril.
Yeah. And, you know, and also not just, you know, it wasn't just rhetoric. You know, all the new scholarship on Reagan is, you know, looking at his speeches and everything in his writings, it shows like it's all handwritten. He did it himself. I mean, the guy had a real political education coming out of the, I mean, he starts, of course, on the left and he comes to the right. And it just didn't happen, you know, because he started getting money from General Electric, you know, or because of Nancy Davis's father. You know, he was a kind of self-tutored guy on this stuff. He wasn't a great intellectual. I don't want to oversell it. But he really did work his way through the arguments. And I think that's, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why the left is in disarray. But I think that's one of them is just not willing to kind of do the long march, not through the institutions, but through the texts.
Well, tell an anecdote here that I think illustrates some of your points. I was, as you know, and maybe most listeners don't, I was in the Party of the Right when I was in college at Yale in the early 1970s. There were very few of us in those days, maybe a dozen active members. I think it's very different now. But as they say in the Party of the Right, you're a member for life at least. So I was always invited to their annual banquet. And I decided some years ago to go to the 50th anniversary because I thought that'd be kind of fun. And I brought my wife, Liza, with me, and she had never seen anything quite like it.
And you say in your book that the right has always been wilder than a lot of people credit it for. And this is a fine example of it. Here, a Party of the Right event typically begins with the current chairman, call that even if it's a woman, reciting the kings and queens of England from memory, and then taking a sip from this big cup of punch, green punch, rather vile stuff. Passing it to the right, of course, to the previous chairman, who then recites Charles I's execution speech, which contains the phrase, "A subject and sovereign are clean different things." Mm-hmm. The people know nothing of governance. Mm-hmm. It's really none of their business. Eliza was struck that an American conservative would be so fond of monarchy and the old country, but also this the deep anti-democratic nature of it really surprised her. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, this was old hat.
Right.
I hadn't been in a Party of Right event in many years, but you know, it was familiar stuff. But what does that tell you? What does that reveal about the right?
Well, I mean, two things. One, as you say, there is a profoundly anti-democratic ideology on the right, and it gets masked oftentimes by the populism of the right. And I think those two things are very, very different things. People forget this. I'll talk more about the populism in a second, but you know. In the reaction against the French Revolution, the Vendée and other kinds of forms, those were popular mobilizations. Like it's never just been an elite project. It's always been an anti-democratic project, but part of the success of the project has hinged upon being able to find shock troops in the street. You know, and of course, fascism is the culmination of that project of trying to find a kind of popular form of anti-democracy. But that starts...
And you just can't buy that sort of thing.
What's that?
You can't just buy that sort
of
thing.
No, absolutely not. And so I think, so this becomes the second point, which is, and this is the problem with, I think, people like Tom Frank and all the rest of it, is that they think you actually can swindle or fool people into that, and you can't. I think there is actually something to the populism.
Also, Tom Frank would say that you read him and you think the right populism is a rather recent innovation.
Right, absolutely. And it's an old one. But he thinks it's a kind of a diversion, right? You know, it's like you give them the red meat of the culture wars and then it's you know, but you're really, all you care about is the economy. And I think it kind of misses the point, because the most successful forms of right-wing populism, and I really trace this to the slaveholders in the United States, I think they pioneered this. There's lots of different kinds, but the most successful one is where you offer a significant mass constituency the opportunity, sometimes even the reality, to play the part of a little king. And it happens in the family and it happens in the workplace. You see glimmers of this, believe it or not, in John Adams. John Adams was very astute. He makes this comment.
Very interesting exchange of letters between Adams and his wife.
Absolutely. So there's that. But even, I think, more interesting, he wrote something called The Discourses on Davila, which was a kind of reading of Adam Smith and some of the stuff in the Scottish Enlightenment. But he says there, and Rousseau actually makes a very similar claim, which is that basically the way a hierarchy works is people are always willing to submit to somebody above them. But on one very important condition, which is that they are able to dominate somebody below them. And you can put up with all manner of inequalities just so long as you're not the one on the very bottom rung. And Adams has a very kind of funny thing, which is about this beggar, pauper, who refused to sell his dog to feed himself. And somebody said, well, why not?
He said, well, I think experimental economists call this last place aversion.
Oh, really?
Yes. They've done some experiments on this. People will put up with all kinds of things as long as they're not in the last place.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I don't like to get into too many psychological arguments, but I think there's some kind of political truth there that's very important. And the slaveholders got it very clearly. And so there was a, ultimately unsuccessful, but a kind of concerted effort amongst the real avant-garde of the slaveholding class to make sure that every white man was a slaveholder, at least one slave. Because they very clearly saw that if you could not make slaveholding in some ways a kind of vaguely mass project, I say vaguely because obviously it's not a genuine mass project and can't be, then you're going to kind of radically truncate your base. And that's not just a political tactic. It becomes a vision. You know, I take Huey Long's Every Man a King, which he meant something very different by it, but I take it as the kind of ultimate motto of right-wing populism, which is literally to make every man, every white man at least, a little king, a little sovereign in the house. And that's how you make it a kind of democratic feudalism.
And if not in the cotton field, then in his household, where he can boss the wife and kids around.
Exactly. I mean, and that's where I think Frank gets the whole thing wrong. Like, abortion, the whole thing about reproductive freedom is extraordinarily important. I mean, first of all, they've been a lot more successful than he gives them credit for. But it's not a diversion. The same logic that drives that argument is the same logic about giving employers arbitrary discretionary authority in the workplace. It's that you want there to be a kind of feudal, a little lord who governs his domain, whatever that domain may be.
I'm speaking with Corey Robin, author of The Reactionary Mind, a collection of essays just out from Oxford University Press. Now, you mentioned Calhoun. He was very frequently quoted in the halls of the Party of the Right. Always three names: John Caldwell Calhoun, the man that Richard Hofstadter called the Marx of the master class.
Yeah, it's a great line. You know, they have a college named after him, don't they?
Calhoun College.
Which is just incredible when you think about it. It's Goebbels College or something like that.
Well, but he's been sanitized.
Yeah.
Well, this is, you know, the college itself is named after a slave trader. But what role does Calhoun play in American conservatism? I think it's a fairly large one, but like, how is he exemplary?
Well, in a couple of ways. I mean, what's interesting is in any American political thought intro class or reader, or any conservatism reader, he gets invoked, one of his various writings. But they're always very selective about what they invoke. It's a couple of his sort of critiques of majoritarian constitutionalism, which in and of itself is really important and kind of damning. I mean, people think you can kind of be a Democrat and anti-majoritarian in a fundamental sense. I mean, I'm not just talking about protecting rights of minorities. I'm talking about somebody who's really, you know, basically said the Declaration of Independence was wrong. He says this, I mean, quite literally, Jefferson just made a mistake in those opening passages about freedom and equality being universal. So he's kind of, in a weird way, he's considered the kind of the good guy of the slaveholding class that you can kind of rehabilitate. And so a couple of years, I don't know, when it was 2004, 2003, I was teaching an American political thought course at the Graduate Center, and I thought, you know, what the hell? Let's take a look and read this guy. And the Liberty Fund, which is this great right-wing outfit that out of Indianapolis, funded by some right-wing business dude, has an unbelievable publishing house that, you know, does all the stuff of the right. From Burke onward, and even before that. And they have a great volume of all of the greatest hits of John C. Calhoun, unsanitized. And, you know, slavery is so central. It's not just an accidental part of the vision. It is the vision. And he's one of these guys who says, I mean, there's a great quote that I think I use from, I can't remember exactly which one of his speeches it was, but where he says, basically, you know, with us in the South, the division is not between rich and poor. It's between white and black. And every white man is an aristocrat. Everyone, it's just by virtue of having that white skin. And, you know, there's a whole kind of literature on whiteness studies and all the rest of it. And, you know, this is the guy who kind of invented it, the whole theory of whiteness. And then what's even more interesting is that how you then translate that into his whole critique and defense of states' rights. I think it might have been Hofstadter who made this point. You know, here he is defending the freedom of the states and slavery at the same time. You know, how is this possible? But that's not a contradiction or a paradox. That is right there, the conservative vision or part of the conservative vision, which is the sort of defense of localism, precisely because the local is the sphere where you can have a kind of little aristocrat who governs his minions.
I think some people would object to a single label, conservative or reactionary, that covers such a broad array of personalities and thinkers and writers. What is your common feature that brings them all together?
Well, I think it's two things, and you're not everybody objects. I mean, I've been sort of presenting this argument, the introduction of the book, to a whole bunch of places where there are many non-conservatives. And the single thing that gets people's back up the most is this notion that you could generalize about the right. And it's an interesting, I mean, just as a sort of an epistemological thing, it's interesting to me because we use the terms all the time. Everybody does. And yet, when you want to try to give any kind of meaning to it, then all of a sudden people say, well, this, you know, it's a meaningless term. And there's a kind of strange move that goes on there. But for me, I think it's really two things. One is, as I said, the defense of inequality, which is not really the right word, because when we think of inequality, we think, you know, some people have more money or less. And I don't think that's what conservatives, they're not interested. I mean, they are interested in that, but that's not really the key. It's really personal forms of rule in a kind of very old world sense of domination, where you have higher beings governing lower beings. And I think that's really the key. But, and here's the second part of that, it's the defense of that in response to and a kind of insurgent challenge. In other words, and Carl Mannheim has a brilliant essay on conservatism that I really recommend everybody should read. It's one of the best things I've ever read, and really a generative kind of source of reflection for me. There are regimes of hierarchy all the time, and they've existed throughout history. Conservatism is not the defense of that, because in the absence of a kind of reformist or insurgent or revolutionary, whatever word you want to use, challenge, those regimes don't oftentimes need any kind of fundamental defense. It's when they get challenged and threatened that then ideologues, philosophers, theorists, whatever the word is you want to call it, I think Theodore White called them action intellectuals, which is kind of a nice phrase, they have to go back to the drawing board and say how the mere fact that we are being threatened, that the mere fact that the ruling class cannot rule is a legitimation problem of epic proportion, and we need to rethink the foundations of its governance. And so in the process of that, they will come up with a kind of a new defense, which will vary across time. And that's my big point, is that it's not that you don't see variation across time, but it's variations on a theme or a project. And the project is this defense of rule in the face of a concerted threat or challenge.
And they're frightened of the spread of equality.
Absolutely. Very much so.
Oh.
But again, equality, I really want to stress this. It's not simple, because when you use that word and people think, oh, well, if you know this person has more money, simply, that's equality. And they are threatened by that, but it's precisely because more money implies that you have the subordinate class as a form of agency that then they can leverage against you. It's really much more about power, I think, in the end, than it is, you know, simple distribution of funds.
As Negri said in one of his more lucid moments, money has one face, that of the boss.
Exactly.
Going back to my experience at the Party of the Right anniversary banquet, though, there was, you know, after there's this whole toasting ritual, and there are many appalling moments during the toasting ritual. Like a toast to the British Empire and its American successor, and to building a cathedral in Riyadh and a basilica in Mecca, I think was another. But one guy stood out, and he said, I liked us better when we were in a minority. Mm. And now that we're so powerful and dominant, this was when George Bush was riding high, and, you know, 80% approval ratings. We've gotten lazy and complacent, which is kind of a paradox, because, you know, the right seems very dominant now, very powerful. Our current president is in many ways a kind of conservative, and yet there's no threat. There's no revolution for them to be counter to. Mm-hmm. So where does that put the right at the current conjuncture?
Well, and this is where I come to in my conclusion, which is I've shot this argument around, and people despise it. But and I say it very tentatively, because I'm not, you know, I always say every prediction I make has been proven wrong. So don't, you know, listen to me on this front. But I actually think that the success of the right is in fact the beginning of the end for it, precisely because conservatism is a project of counter-revolution. And when there's no more revolution to oppose, it's sort of has nowhere to go. And I read the Tea Party in some ways as, two things. One is, so now you have a kind of intellectual kind of vacuity on the right that a lot of conservatives have begun to notice. There just doesn't seem to be any ideas. And there's a reason there's no ideas, and that's because there's no need for them. You know, it's kind of, the project is now on automatic pilot. And in the absence of a kind of genuine insurgent challenge, the only one I could even think of is the gay rights movement, and that didn't seem to really, in the end, be so threatening to them. But in the absence of that, you see a kind of real fall off intellectually. And it's interesting, I mean, I quote Hayek, and people like Frank Meyer, who was the kind of real intellectual architect of the right in the 60s, the sort of intellectual political architect. And, you know, they're very clear that we need to be embattled. politically in order to be intellectually fertile. And there's a very long history of that. So I think the first signs of it are that. And then secondly, I think the Tea Party is, my reading of the Tea Party, the comparison I always make is to the Congress that was elected in 1974, which was a reform Congress, lots of left-wing Democrats, particularly on questions about imperial power and the imperial presidency, and begin to pass a series of legislation that, you know, by historical measures were kind of out there. And, you know, if you were an observer at that time, in 1974, you would say, okay, you know, the New Deal, the left has a whole new lease on life here that's just beginning. And that's what the Tea Party kind of looks like. But of course, we have to be careful about this, but we know 6 years later, that project was, you know, smashed to smithereens. I'm not saying in 6 years we're going to get the left-wing version of Reagan. But I do think that my hunch is, and it's just a hunch, is that you're beginning to see the beginning of the end of this. Now, how long it takes, you know, is a very open question. And how much damage they do on their way out, I think, is also a very important. I mean, they can do an awful lot of stuff. And then there's one other question, which my colleague Andy Polsky has said, which is that, you know, they can get a certain amount of mileage out of running against the kind of residue of the welfare state. In other words, the left has some kind of congealed form, at least symbolically.
They haven't privatized Social Security yet.
Exactly. And you can run against that. You can, you know, I don't think it's very popular. It doesn't seem, even the Tea Party, a lot of those people, actually, that's one thing they don't want to touch is Social Security and Medicare. How much power they have, I don't know. But anyway, you can run against the kind of afterglow of the left. You know, Obama, you know, as a black president, you know, that's the afterglow of the left to them. So you can probably get a certain amount of mileage.
And parts of the left very happily play along.
Absolutely, as we have seen. But so you can get some mileage out of it. I just think in the end, like, reality is reality, you know. And if you don't have a real... This is an argument I get into with Joe Lowndes, who's at the University of Oregon in political science, who's a very good scholar of the right. You know, he thinks that there's a kind of endless capacity for reinvention, protean reinvention. And I guess in the end, I'm a kind of a political materialist in that sense, that, you know, it's just... There's such a thing as a real social insurgency and an absence of one. And we are living in a long absence. And until it becomes a reality again, I just don't think you're going to see the kind of intellectual and then ultimately political fertility that we saw on the right between, let's say, the 1950s and the 1980s.
We're listening to Corey Robin, author of The Reactionary Mind, a collection of essays just out from Oxford University Press. Part two after the break. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back in 2006, National Review put together a list of 50 conservative rock songs. Some of the entries are a stretch, but some are anything but. This is number two on the list, and the only time you'll ever hear the Beatles on this show, George Harrison's complaint about Britain's 95% top tax rate in the 1960s.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small?
That was the Beatles doing Taxman, number two on National Review's list of the 50 great conservative rock songs of all time. And now part two of my interview with Corey Robin, author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin.
You talk about the romanticism of the right, and I recall my days in that strange precinct in the early 1970s, when there were not very many of us. We felt doomed. We were fighting the good but lost battle. We love that quote from Whitaker Chambers. It's idle to talk about preserving Western civilization. It's already a wreck from within. I was actually looking up that quote recently and found that it's on the website of a Georgia congressman, which is a measure of how things have changed.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That member of Congress would actually use that as his motto. But what about that sense? You talk about the sense of loss that pervades so much conservative discourse, even when they're winning. What is that sense of loss, and why is it so important to them?
Well, there's a couple of levels at which I'd answer that. One is purely instrumental, which I don't want to overstate it too much, but it's clearly true that there's a discourse of victimology, for lack of a better word, that is created by the kind of democratic enlightenment. Rousseau is in some ways the first theoretician of it. He was called the philosopher of the Homer of the loser, and there's some truth to that. It was really, how does society look? He was the first person to really say, how do we look at society from the perspective of the bottom, and what do we learn from that? And that has become and always been an extraordinarily powerful matrix by which to view things. And the thing about the right was that they got in on it very quickly. Burke, you know, is the first one in a certain way, in his whole treatment of Marie Antoinette. And, you know, scholars puzzle over why does, you know, in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, why does he spend? I mean, it's probably the longest passage in the book, the description of the abduction of Marie Antoinette and the royal family from the palace at Versailles and the march to Paris. And the reason I think, and people say, well, the reason he likes it is because it's classical tragedy, right? The fall of the great. But as I try to make the point, tragedy is classical tragedy. What makes it that is that these are irreversible events, and that all you can do, the only hope you get, is the kind of the kind of afterglow of meaning that you can extract from it. But it's irreversible and it's irredeemable, and that's what its tragedy is. It's the irreversibility and the irredeemability of the event itself. But Burke is not writing from that perspective. Burke is writing from the perspective that we can make this whole, right? We can recover this, which makes it a much more modern point of view, and it makes it much more familiar, much more similar to the Rousseauist democratic project in a certain kind of way, which is that we can make this whole, this loss. But in order to do it, we have to kind of use that language, that democratic language of victimhood and so forth. So there's an instrumental quality to it. But I do think there's also something deeper than that. It's this romantic quality that we've been talking about, which is that there are winners and losers in politics, right? Oftentimes these are zero-sum games. If you want to dispossess the slaveholding class, you're taking something away from them. And that is real. That is not illusory. That is not imaginary. I mean, it's money. Historians have estimated it's one of the largest expropriations of private property in the history of the planet. So it's real money. And it's also, you know, symbolic status. And it's also real rule and domination. And I oftentimes feel like the left just doesn't get that. They don't see that, because the slaveholder had no right to own the person in the first place. That's true, but they were doing it for hundreds of years, and you're taking something away that's quite real from them. So that discourse of loss is a reflection of a material reality. It also has, I think the right is very smart to play on it, because it, you know, every loss is a universal experience, and we all die. You know, we all lose loved ones, and I don't want to put too much stock on this, but I do think there is an extent to which that discourse of death, whether it's the death of a civilization or the death of a society or the death of, you know, a social, whatever it might be, is the closest thing that the right has to a universalist project, because it's something that we all participate in. And they would be unwise, I think, to give up on it entirely. The problem from the right is when they dwell on it, when it becomes like your friends in the party of the right, when it's just a sinking ship and we want to go down with the ship. That has always been a loser for the right. The real successes on the right is when they said, yes, we are on a sinking ship, but, and this is Burke's point, we can bring it back up.
Well, that's the genius of Reagan.
That's Reagan.
To make that
exactly
a popular message.
Yeah.
Once again, going back to my Party of the Right experience, the great split within the party in those days was the traditionalists versus libertarians. And this is a split that still exists on the right, although it's sometimes murky. But, you know, the traditionalists were... there were a few monarchists among them. They tended to be either Catholic or very high church Episcopalians. And the libertarians were wild men. They loved the market. A couple of them, like, manufactured drugs in their dorm rooms. And their discourse was about freedom and not tradition, or liberty was the word they preferred to freedom. Mm-hmm. Your book, I think, doesn't really look enough at that appeal of freedom.
Yeah.
And what that means to people of a libertarian persuasion. You have a wonderful piece on Ayn Rand, who, of course, a complete lunatic. But the appeal is perhaps to an adolescent conception of freedom, mm-hmm. or an adolescent male conception of freedom. Yeah. But the revolution, the appeal to revolution, the overturning of hierarchies, it presents itself as an anti-hierarchical doctrine,
yeah.
that there are all these structures of inherited wealth and power that a truly unrestricted free market will constantly overturn. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Marx in the Communist Manifesto, yeah. Celebrating the revolutionary power of capitalism. They embrace that with, mm-hmm. So did Marx to some degree.
Right.
What about that appeal of freedom? I mean, is it pure nonsense? Is there some content to it? Mm-hmm. What do you make of it?
I think there is. It's definitely not nonsense. And I also agree that I think this is the weakest part of the book. It's something I came to very late, to starting to grapple with it. And now I'm sort of full square grappling with it. I'm doing a really long piece on Hayek for The Nation, and hoping to launch on my blog a kind of a Hayek reading club for the left, which will look at the constitutional liberty over a period of 10 weeks and read kind of 50 pages of it. And I think kind of getting square on that and really understanding the free market as a counter-revolutionary movement is, to my mind, it's the critical thing to kind of understand. And here's, I guess, sort of my very, this is, again, very early, but my provisional take on the libertarians and how they fit in. And you mentioned something earlier about the party of the right, which is that they feared that they didn't like being in the driver's seat, right? That they felt like there was too much power on their side. And that actually has been a very pervasive discourse on the right across, you know, the spectrum of the right, libertarian doesn't matter, that real fear of decadence of the ruling class, and it begins again with Burke and across the English Channel with Joseph de Maistre, who's one of the people I try to kind of rehabilitate in the book. And it's a sense that one of the reasons why the revolution came, a big reason, was precisely that the ruling class had gotten too comfy and cozy with its privileges and had grown soft and weak as a result. And it's fascinating in de Maistre.
It's like Thatcher's contempt for the Tory wet.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you see this, Calhoun and his lieutenant, James Henry Hammond in South Carolina, who's even in some ways more interesting. The rage they had against the master class was almost greater than the rage against the abolitionists, because, and I think in a way, rightly so, they viewed the two things, the strength of the abolitionists as the kind of a mirror image of the weakness of the master class, of a master class that had just kind of gotten too soft. And so what you have then is a desire always to come up with new forms of ruling and new forms of domination that will overcome that problem. Now, I think early on, one of the ways that they thought you could do this is just the project of counter-revolution itself, right? So de Maistre, you know, has these incredibly Jacobin passages in Considerations on France of just, you know, of this revolutionary fire just kind of laying waste to everything in the old regime. And he welcomes it because he thinks out of that wasteland will emerge a more powerful new ruling class. So the experience of counter-revolution is one thing. War is another biggie. And it's particularly, there's something about the experience of the battlefield where they think all your traditional privileges and trappings are completely stripped away. And really it will be, whoever wins is really the best man. The one with the greatest wit, I mean, not humor, but, you know, intelligence, and the greatest muscle. And I think Nietzsche is kind of very much in that vein, and that's how I look at a lot of his writings on
war. We saw a lot of that here in 2003, 2004.
Absolutely. The neocons, you know, it's very much the whole part of their vision. And I talk a lot about that in the second half of the book. So that's the second experience. What I came to see slowly is that for a lot of the theoreticians on the right, the market was really now was a third arena in which the better man could step forward. And that, therefore, and Schumpeter's, creative destruction is so powerful on this theme, and that's what it's all about. That kind of that sort of constant metabolism of the capitalist marketplace, I mean, he has great stuff about it's not in Capitalism, Socialism, Democracy. It's in an essay he wrote from the 20s, which I can't remember, something about what explains the rise and fall of ethnic groups and families. And, you know, it's all about a family, a capitalist dynasty that just hoards, you know, and doesn't invest and doesn't constantly risk and get out there in the market is a dying class, and it will die. And I think that really is the Darwinian nature of the marketplace, and that freedom is critical. Freedom understood and the absence, you know, kind of, you need an absence of constraints. You need a kind of semi-permeable set of institutions. It's not quite a meritocracy, and I try to stress this. The meritocracy, you know, is kind of McNamara's, you know, it's sort of the people who kind of do all the right things. Their idea is not that. It's much more of a transgressive vision. Von Mises has a great line about this in his early chapters on socialism. It's, you know, it's the kind of transgressive violence of the first person who is willing to take something for his own and then kind of make use of it. And
I remember a column William Safmeyer wrote denouncing the law of the sea treaties. The sea should belong to those with the wit and capital to exploit it.
Yeah, exactly. And it has to be a kind of vaguely free arena, because if it's not, and I think this is where you see a lot of libertarians critique, I mean, we've talked about this in other venues, why they critique the sort of corporatist state and all the rest of it. And I don't think it's insincere by any stretch. I mean, they really do want this kind of massively unregulated arena where warriors of the market can, you know, joust and best each other. But it's ultimately not really... it's not what we think of as freedom, I think. I mean, it's not really trying to emancipate people. It's much more of an instrumental value in order to kind of, and this is very clear in Hayek, for instance. I mean, people always misread Hayek as a kind of celebrant of individual freedom, you know, a kind of rights-based view. It's nothing could be further from the truth. Freedom for him is purely instrumental. It is the vehicle by which this kind of Darwinian supremacy can be achieved. And
well, it's kind of a natural sorting mechanism.
Exactly, exactly. And then, some of them vary on this, but, you know, then you can sort of dominate the people beneath you as well. It doesn't get talked about that much. But anyway, I think that's really how I view the discourse of freedom. It's not at all insincere. It's not incidental. It's fundamental. But it's in keeping with what we stereotypically think of as the more traditional forms of the right. Burke, you know, he has this wonderful text called Letter to a Noble Lord. He'd been challenged by a kind of, you know, reformist Whig saying that you shouldn't get your pension, Burke. And he felt like his honor had been really besmirched. But the guy who challenged him was kind of, you know, really to the manner born, you know, had inherited all of his wealth. And Burke, of course, wasn't. You know, Burke wasn't quite a self-made man.
Well, you point out a lot of these conservative thinkers are outsiders.
They're always outsiders, and he's the original one. And, you know, he writes, I mean, it's an unbelievable text because David Bromwich, the literary scholar, calls it kind of the Jacobin rage, is so intense. You know, he says, you know, like, basically, I was, you know, given nothing. And I've been treated by your people with nothing but suspicious. Every time I think he has some image of like, every time I had to, you know, go through the turnpike, I had to pay my toll. And, you know, I've faced nothing but adversity. And that, in some ways, you know, is the model of the ruling class. He has, you know, it's somebody who kind of fought, you know, not you know, did the right things, but fought to kind of break in. And in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, he basically says his vision of the kind of good society is one where it's not easy to get in. It can't be too easy, but you can do it if you're willing to kind of, you know, if you've got the scrappiness. And I think that's how I kind of read the libertarians. It doesn't surprise me the kind of insurgent modernism of their view. It's very in keeping, I think, with what we stereotypically think of as the more traditionalist forms of the right.
I'm speaking with Corey Robin, author of The Reactionary Mind, a collection of essays from Oxford University Press. We're just about out of time, and we hadn't really talked about this at all, but you know, you point out that there's a kind of American exceptionalism on the American right. We're not like the Europeans. The Europeans are, you know, hierarchical, old-fashioned fuddy-duddies, and we're more of that kind of, you know, this turbulent market kind of conservative revolution. One, do you buy that? And two, is there something very deeply, fundamentally conservative about American society in that sense, that it's almost, you know, a native strain of thought?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do and I don't. The extent to which I do is that there was, I should be careful here, but I think there was more of a debate in Europe, particularly in the 19th century, about the market and about capitalism. And I read the history of conservatism in Europe as primarily a story of kind of a learning curve whereby the right began to see the possibilities of capitalism and the market to fulfill right-wing projects. I mean, it really gets going, I think, in the 1880s, 1890s in Britain and elsewhere. But, you know, like particularly in places like Germany in the turn of the 19th century, there's a lot of suspicion. You know, the French, that's, you know, that's the world of commerce, and, you know, we're the people of the soil. And you don't quite have that in the States. I should be careful there. I have a student who just wrote a great dissertation showing that, in fact, there's a very strong anti-capitalist strain in the American right going back to the very beginning. But I think there might be some differences there. But that said, again, people forget, Burke was not hostile to the market. He wrote a lot of stuff that was kind of really primitive. I mean, C.B. McPherson, the Marxist political theorist, wrote a great little book on Burke and looked particularly at his kind of ideas about political economy. And to some degree, they're, you know, kind of, he's not cutting edge or anything like that, but he really is, you know, operating in a kind of Smithian vein. Likewise, Disraeli. I mean, people always think, oh, you know, he's kind of great, but not so, you know, very much interested in certain kind of aspects of the market. So that's a wishy-washy answer. I would say probably the embrace of the market in the United States was more powerful. Even the slaveholders, you know, Eugene Genovese was a fabulous, brilliant scholar, but he really did a disservice to the scholarship on slavery by sort of depicting the slaveholders as kind of anti-capitalist. I mean, he was actually in his earlier work much more careful about that. But, you know, the slaveholders, you know, I don't think I wrote about this in the book, but they really were, you know, you read their stuff, it's all, they're invoking Smith, the John Stuart Mill and his father, James Mill, Ricardo. They have a whole political economy, but it's based on slave labor. And it's that attempt, which I say this, I think in the book, makes them actually much closer to the Nazis, who also had a vision of political economy based on slave labor, but it was a capitalist vision. I mean, people, you know, get screwed up about that.
Where would the mills of Manchester been without the cotton from the South?
Right? Exactly.
So then there are people on the right who argue that the United States is a deeply conservative country, that, and that, you know, we have all these foreign imports, social democracy, whatever, but it just doesn't really, it doesn't really fit here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that?
I'm leery of any kind of culturalist argument because, you know, I feel like people, particularly on the left, turn to kind of culturalist arguments at moments of defeat. You see this, I mean, I think we've talked about this in the past, but, you know, you see this all the time, you know, after a revolutionary or left-wing movement is defeated, all of a sudden you get this kind of culturalist arguments. So I'm leery of it at that level, but at one level I think it's very, very true. And this, sorry, it's the sort of political scientist in me, which is that we have a state that is extraordinarily fragmented and decentralized by design, that was built expressly for the purposes of counter-majoritarianism. You know, we read the Federalist Papers. You know, what is Madison's vision? It's a big, sprawling republic where majorities from the bottom can't figure out that they have interests in common, and if they can, they can't really communicate with each other, and if they can communicate with each other, there's these institutions that they're just going to have to get around, and it becomes this indecipherable maze of veto points and checkpoints.
It's always bizarre when you see liberals defending that.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
It's like, I mean, they don't really understand what it's all about.
They don't. And it's, you know, it's one of my big constant arguments with the left. And it's not just liberals, it's also leftists of the kind of more anarchistic fear of a centralized state variety, that they don't understand that that was a conservative project. It always was. I mean, it, to the extent it predates sort of Burke and the French Revolution, you see it in Montesquieu, who was a kind of defender of feudal, kind of visionary defender of feudal privileges against a centralizing monarch. It's Tocqueville. And it has been really, I think, the single most important thing that has stifled and stymied the left. I mean, as I said recently in an exchange with somebody, you know, go look at those copper wars that Anthony Lucas talked about in Big Trouble. Which is a great book, you know, in Colorado and Utah. Look at the miners' wars in West Virginia. I mean, there is a level of Jacobin ferocity there that is intense, you know, and it certainly parallels what you see in the Parisian streets in the early 1790s. But it has nowhere to go. I mean, A, it's very easily put down precisely because it's so local. And B, even when it's not put down, you know, so what? So you capture Denver. Big deal. You know, there's a big country out there. And it's not just geographically big. It's an administrative sprawl. And you've got to do it everywhere. You know, you could take Paris, and you may or may not have control of the country. But there's no nodal point like that in the United States. And I see that as primarily an institutional problem. And it's something that I think historians don't really pay enough attention to, because they're more interested in culture and identity and all these things that are important. But those institutions really matter.
Yeah, we have, 50 or 60,000 governmental units in the United States. It's an enormous number.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking with a friend of ours, and you know, who has a vision of revolutionary action, and I said, you know, what's your vision? And she laid it out, and you know, there's a lot of state power out there you got to capture. It's just not built like that, and people, it's not built in that centralized way. And by that, I don't mean it's a weak state. I had an exchange with Alex Gurevich about this, because he said, well, look, the ruling class is able to do a lot of things with that state. I said, precisely, that's the point. The more decentralized it is, the more they benefit from it, the more we suffer from it.
Yeah, you'd have to be psychotic to say the U.S. state is weak.
No, that's not at all the point, but it is decentralized.
All right, thanks, Corey.
We've been listening to Corey Robin, professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of The Reactionary Mind, a collection of essays just out from Oxford University Press. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with the number one entry, which I have to admit I really love despite the message, on National Review's list of the 50 great conservative rock songs of all time, The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again. Till next week, bye.